It's the Science Times podcast for Tuesday, October 16th. I'm David Corcoran of the New York Times. This week, a downtown dig in the capital of Vietnam, the triumphs and tribulations of a school nurse, and the invasion of the killer frogs, part two. On the front page of Science Times this week, we go to Hanoi, the capital of Vietnam, for one of the world's richest archaeological digs. Freelance writer Jennifer Pinkowski visited a ruin called Thang Long and wrote about the efforts to reclaim the artifacts of a lost civilization that dates back almost exactly 1,000 years. Jen, set the scene for us. Where's the archaeological dig you visited, and what's the setting like?
The dig is located in downtown Hanoi. It's just northwest of Hoan Kiam Lake, which is considered the sort of heart of Hanoi. And it's in an area that's just adjacent to several major sites in Hanoi, including Ho Chi Minh's mausoleum, the museum associated with him, Ba Dinh Square, where Ho Chi Minh proclaimed the formation of independent Vietnam in 1945. So it's clearly in an area that is important today and has been for a long time.
So this is like having an archaeological dig in Central Park or something.
It is. The fact that it is where it is a sort of indication of Hanoi's importance over 1,000 years.
The place has quite a rich history. Tell us about it.
Well, Thang Long was founded in 1010 by Emperor Li Taito.
Almost a thousand years ago.
And it was the imperial capital of Vietnam, of the Great Viet, of Northern Vietnam, for about 900 years, almost consistently. There were repeated invasions by the Mongols and by the Chinese over the years. But for the majority of that time, it was the administrative and governmental capital. So, you know, there were three major dynasties, the Li, which lasted through about the 13th century, then the Tran through about the 15th, and then the Le, which lasted until about the late 18th century, when the Nguyen dynasty from the south eventually conquered all of Vietnam.
And all of those dynasties left their artifacts on the site?
They all left their mark there. They made adjustments to the layout of the site. They expanded buildings. They had distinctive pottery styles and architectural styles. And the archaeologists are dealing with millions of artifacts right now. And part of what they'll be doing, what they're doing now, what they'll continue to do, is to puzzle out the individual characteristics of each of the dynasties.
You mention in your story that there's quite an infrastructure down there, brick roads, foundations of palaces.
Mm-hmm. They found the foundations of at least 11 palaces, various administrative buildings, everything oriented around a sort of forbidden palace in the center where the king and the royal family and entourage would have been. And so everything is oriented around that central building and complex. And from there, various buildings and roads fan out. There had been four gates that were entrances into the palace, and of course those would have been manned by army.
Talk about some of the artifacts that they're finding. One that you mentioned sounds really extraordinary, a white porcelain dish.
It's really beautiful to see. And the way they have it positioned in the small on-site museum is to have it prominently displayed in a window so that natural light comes in so it can be backlit, and you can see the intricate designs that are within the very thin-walled, transparent ceramic. It's important for a couple of reasons. One is that the design has a five-toed dragon on it, and that's always a symbol of the king, and very much inherited from a Chinese imperial tradition. The second reason is that its quality is so high, and Vietnamese ceramics were not considered to be as high quality as Chinese, and generally aren't. So what they're finding here at this imperial site is some sort of native tradition, it appears, of high quality ceramics. One thing that they haven't found, however, is any evidence on site kilns, which they would expect to find. You'd expect to find that if they're producing ceramics on site for royal use, they have to have kilns for them. They haven't found that. They've only found waste slag so far. So there's still some questions out there about that. You know, that the finding of the slag is interesting but inconclusive.
What is the outlook? So many archaeological sites tend to be plundered or badly dug up and badly maintained. Do you see the Tonglong site as being something for the long term?
I think so. I think the future of Tonglong looks pretty promising. They've put it so much on the national and international stage that its prominence gives it some protection. Also, Vietnam's first heritage laws, heritage protection laws, were put into place after the finding of Tonglong. So there actually are mechanisms for protecting it now. This is a bit of new territory for many Asian cities and definitely new territory for Vietnam. But with a bid for UNESCO status in place for the site and it being so central to the commemorations of the 1,000-year anniversary of the founding of Hanoi in 2010, it looks like Tonglong is not going to be disappeared as happens a lot of times at various sites, particularly considering that this was supposed to be the site of the new parliament building for Vietnam, which is the highest governmental body in Vietnam. That could have been a really good scenario for these finds to disappear. And so it's pretty interesting that they didn't.
Jennifer Pinkowski is an independent journalist based in New York City who writes about science, travel, and culture. Her article about the dig at Tonglong in Vietnam is in Science Times this week. Jen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
In our health segment this week, another in a series of profiles by reporter Jan Hoffman on people on the front lines of medical care. This week, her subject is Pam Palmieri, or Mrs. Palmieri, to her students at the middle school in Millburn, New Jersey. I caught up with Mrs. Palmieri in her office. Mrs. Palmieri, are you having a busy day? Describe your morning so far.
Yes, I'm actually having a very busy day. I've already seen roughly about 40 students.
40 students? It sounds like the ER on Friday night. What's going on?
Well, for some reason today, we have a lot of gym injuries, a lot of jammed fingers and ankle twists and that type of thing. So I've had a lot of students come in with those types of problems today and calling some parents just to let them know. So far, I don't think I've had any real serious issues, but there's a few that I will check before the end of the day again just to make sure. We've also had quite a few headaches, stomach aches, but that's every day.
What kind of training do you need to be a school nurse?
Well, you need to have your RN, registered nurse. And for myself, I went to a hospital school, which was very popular back in the 70s when I went to nursing school. And it was affiliated with Union County College. So I got a diploma in nursing and an associate's degree. I, after that, went on to get my bachelor's degree in community health at Jersey City State College at the time. And then I took there at Jersey City school nurse certification courses, just geared to the school nurse certification.
Dealing with children and their special health needs.
Yes. You review testing that you do on the students, vision, scoliosis, hearing, how to do it, what to report, you know, what's normal, what's not, that type of thing. And a lot of the courses involve that. And then once you have that certification, you're then technically clear to become a school nurse.
You've been a school nurse now for what, 17 years?
17 years. This is my 17th year, yes.
How has the job changed over that time?
Well, when I first started, basically it was medical stuff. You know, you took care of being sure that immunizations were up to date and TB testing was done. We, of course, did the vision and hearing and that type of thing. And then it was the routine Band-Aids, stomach aches, headaches, and that was about it. Nowadays, I find that my role has really grown. I feel like I'm a counselor in a lot of ways. I spend a lot of time with the students. If students are having issues, even a lot of emotional issues, they do find that my office is kind of a safe haven for them. They like to come in and sit, and they can just kind of relax and maybe clear their head a little bit. You know, just in talking, especially with the girls, you know, they're adolescent girls, and they're going through some changes in their bodies and whatever. And, you know, I use the time here, especially if it's quiet and I have a couple of girls here, to talk to them and, you know, to try to explain some of the changes and, you know, what they're feeling and what they can do about it, that type of thing. So really, my job has continued being medical, but I'm also more of like a counselor, just somebody that they can come and talk to. My office is a place where they can come just to kind of take it easy a little bit and just get away from the stress for a few minutes.
Now, you've already seen 40 kids this morning, and I guess that makes potentially 80 frantic parents who probably don't want to get a phone call from you. What's it like dealing with parents these days?
It can be difficult. In the community that I work in, there is a mix. We do have many parents, many mothers especially, that are home during the day. We do have some fathers, too, that are around, and that makes the job a little easier in a lot of ways, because if you do need them, they usually are available to come in to check on their child or bring them home. But yet we also have a lot of parents that have real high-profile jobs also. And, you know, you have to work around that. And I really try to pick and choose the problems that I call home about. Usually the way I work things is if I make the phone call, it's something that's pretty serious or serious enough that I think the child needs to go home or an issue needs to be addressed. I do often let the children call, and when I do that, it's kind of a signal that the parent needs to make that call, you know, to make that decision as to whether the child should go home or whether the child should stay in school. You know, we do have some children that come in quite a bit, and, you know, in the beginning, the parents tend to come in and take them home right away, that type of thing. And then they learn also that the child maybe just needs a little time out or just needs to talk to the parent, but they need the parent to say, you've got to get back to class.
Pam Palmieri is the school nurse at the middle school in Millburn, New Jersey, and the subject of Jan Hoffman's monthly feature, In the Trenches, in Science Times this week. Mrs. Palmieri, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you very much.
We're joined, as always, by our observatory columnist, Henry Fountain. And Henry, this week, some old friends of the podcast hop back into the picture.
Absolutely. The cane toads of Australia.
Remind our listeners, what is the cane toad's claim to fame?
Well, cane toads are this rather large species of frog that were introduced into Australia in the 1930s. With the hopes that they would wipe out pests in the sugarcane industry.
Bad idea.
Really bad idea. And they've become sort of the poster amphibian for invasive species. They basically have taken over. They were introduced in northeastern Australia, and they've taken over something like 400,000 square miles of northern Australia. Snakes that try to eat them die because they have lots of toxins. Even, you know, dogs that encounter them and try to eat them tend to keel over. So, and they spread incredibly fast. I've written in the past about that the leading edge of this invasion force, which is really what it is, they travel something like, you know, they can spread like a couple hundred feet a day, like the actual population. And in fact, at the leading edge, the frogs are moving so fast that they're actually evolving longer legs and bigger bodies. So it's quite an amazing invasion.
Quite a horror movie. What's the sequel?
Well, they're actually getting their just desserts in a way. What's happened, the same people that studied these cane toads for a while realized when they were studying them that some of the largest ones sort of on the invasive front had severe spinal abnormalities, basically bony growths on their spine, which they discovered when they dissect them, that fused their spines and caused them all sorts of basically arthritis-like problems. In fact, it is sort of arthritis. And they found something like 10% of the biggest frogs on the front lines of this invasion were afflicted with arthritis. And they think it's basically the same sort of things that make these species such good invaders is causing them all these health problems. The fact that they move so fast, they hop a lot, they're very active, and they're also getting bigger, their legs are getting longer, so every hop puts more stress on them than before. And also, because they spend so much time expanding their range, the thinking is that maybe their immune systems are not as good because they don't put as much energy into sort of a strong immune system, and therefore they pick up bacteria, and this arthritis is related to a bacteria they pick up from the soil. So the same thing that's allowing them to invade is also affecting their health rather greatly.
Well, not that one would wish suffering on any creature, but is this a hopeful sign? Will it perhaps slow or even stop the invasion of the cane toads?
Well, the researchers don't address that issue directly, but they do point to a rather disturbing sign, which is that when they researched, some of these arthritic frogs into the laboratory and had them hop around on a treadmill, after about 15 minutes or so, the effects of their condition would slow them down. Every hop would be less and less distance. You know, obviously they were in pain or somehow suffering because of their back problems. However, they radio-tracked frogs in the field, arthritic frogs in the field, and their arthritis didn't slow them down at all. They hopped along as fast as the healthy frogs. So there's something about this compelling, like, land grab character of these frogs that makes them just go ahead no matter what their health.
Henry Fountain is the observatory columnist for Science Times. Henry, as always, thanks.
Thank you.
And that's the Science Times podcast for Tuesday, October 16th. Thanks for downloading us. We'll be back next week. I'm David Corcoran of the New York Times.